When Jamaican workers arrived in Costa Rica, they came with more than tools. They brought soul. From railroad tracks to carnival parades, their presence transformed Limón into a living archive of Afro-Caribbean identity. This is the true story of how Jamaican migrants reshaped a nation's culture through language, music, food, and psychological resilience. In this special episode, we uncover the hidden influence of Jamaican tradition on Costa Rica's identity, and how cultural power can become a silent form of manipulation, shaping memory, pride, and resistance for generations to come. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Laying tracks through the jungle, the railroad that brought Jamaica to Costa Rica. The year was 1871, and Costa Rica stood at the edge of transformation. Coffee, the country's golden bean, was booming, but without a railroad, it was trapped in the Central Valley, unable to reach the global markets fast enough. The government's dream was bold: construct a railroad line from the highland capital, San Jose, to the Caribbean port city of Puerto Limón, a distance of just over 100 miles, through some of the most unforgiving terrain in the Americas. Rain-soaked mountains, sweltering lowlands, venomous snakes, deadly diseases, and relentless jungle growth made this no ordinary engineering project. The terrain was so hostile that local Costa Rican laborers refused to continue. Many died within weeks from malaria, yellow fever, and accidents. Others simply walked away. It was then that the project's American contractor, Minor C. Keith, nephew of railway magnate Henry Meigs, looked across the Caribbean Sea and made a decision that would change the cultural fabric of Costa Rica forever. He brought in Jamaicans. Jamaica in the 1870s was still reeling from the aftermath of slavery's abolition just 3 decades earlier. Jobs were scarce, wages low, and poverty widespread. Many Jamaicans were eager for work abroad, and they were no strangers to hard labor. They had already endured generations of sugarcane toil under British colonial rule. When the call came for workers to head to Costa Rica, thousands of men answered. But it wasn't just men who made the journey. Many Jamaicans brought wives, children, and siblings, creating a wave of family-based migration that would take root in Limón Province. They came by steamship, disembarking in Puerto Limón to a wild frontier of mud, rail ties, and swamps. Some came voluntarily. Others, desperate, were misled, believing they'd be paid handsomely or that the job was light. What they found was a brutal reality. The work was grueling. Men hauled steel rails through mangrove swamps, dynamited rocky cliffs, and built bridges over raging rivers. Insects swarmed. Heat suffocated. Rain never ceased. Sickness was constant. Hundreds died. Many more were buried in unmarked graves. Still, the railroad crawled forward. Yet through all this suffering, the Jamaicans endured. They brought with them not just sweat, but soul. English-speaking and often devoutly Christian, the Jamaicans introduced their cultural rhythms to the region. They sang hymns on the worksites. They cooked familiar dishes, dumplings, callaloo, salted fish, even when supplies were limited. They shared jokes in patois, raised tin-roof churches, and held fast to their identity. By the 1890s, nearly the entire workforce building the railroad consisted of Jamaicans and other Afro-Caribbean migrants. Some came from Barbados or Trinidad, but it was the Jamaicans, used to the harsh climate and culturally cohesive, who formed the majority. As the tracks neared completion in 1890, Puerto Limón transformed from a sleepy jungle port to a bustling Afro-Caribbean outpost. The Jamaicans, far from their homeland, had built not just a railroad, they'd begun building a new home. But it would not be a welcoming one. Despite being indispensable to the railroad's completion and the economic rise that followed, Jamaicans were not embraced by the Costa Rican elite. Their blackness, their language, their customs, all became reasons for exclusion. They were denied Costa Rican citizenship. They were barred from migrating inland beyond the coastal provinces. Schools were segregated. Hospitals denied them. Roads were not built in their neighborhoods. And yet they stayed. They built churches, formed cricket teams, opened shops, published English-language newspapers, and raised new generations in Limón. The railroad was finished, but a cultural journey had only begun. What the Costa Rican government had imported as labor had, in truth, planted the seeds of a trans-Caribbean identity. a community that would go on to shape the music, language, cuisine, and spiritual lifeblood of Costa Rica's Atlantic coast. And in the next chapter, we follow them into the banana fields, where new chains would be forged under the name of the United Fruit Company, and where Jamaican resistance would find a new rhythm. Bananas, bosses, and bloodlines. The United Fruit Company era. The steel rails were laid, the last spike driven. By the early 1900s, the Costa Rican Railroad stood complete, a silver artery stretching from San Jose to the Caribbean, pulsing with the promise of profit. But what came next wasn't just transportation, it was domination. Enter the United Fruit Company, a corporate empire so powerful it would later be called El Pulpo, the octopus, for the way its tentacles stretched across Central America, squeezing life from the land and labor from its people. And it all began in the Caribbean lowlands of Costa Rica, on the backs of Jamaicans. Minor C. Keith, the same American tycoon who imported Jamaican workers for the railroad, now had a bigger vision: bananas. With land grants from the Costa Rican government and financing from New York bankers, Keith merged his banana plantations with Boston-based entrepreneurs. Together, they created United Fruit. What followed was nothing short of a colonial empire masquerading as a corporation. In the humid jungles of Limon Province, vast banana plantations replaced forest. Monkeys fled the trees. Rivers were rerouted. Entire landscapes were engineered to serve the banana's needs: drainage canals, dikes, railway sidings. The same tracks built for coffee exports now hauled bananas to waiting steamships bound for New Orleans and beyond. And again, it was the Jamaicans who did the labor. They cleared land. They dug irrigation trenches. They planted, harvested, carried, loaded. The work was endless, backbreaking, and brutally repetitive. Sun up to sun down. And the wages? Barely enough to survive. Yet the Jamaicans stayed. Some did it for their children. Others hoped to return to Jamaica one day with enough savings to buy land. Many, however, knew they were building a permanent life in Costa Rica, even if the country itself refused to recognize them as citizens. United Fruit's reach was total. The company didn't just control the plantations. It ran entire towns. It built worker housing, controlled food supply stores, managed medical clinics, hired and fired local police, and paid off politicians. The workers, including Jamaicans, were treated like disposable cogs. They were segregated into barracks, paid in tokens redeemable only at company stores, denied unions, denied land rights, denied legal standing. But oppression breeds resilience. Jamaican workers began organizing, not in formal unions, those were illegal, but through churches, social clubs, and secret gatherings. They formed cricket leagues to boost morale. They passed down African-Caribbean songs of resistance. They built mutual aid societies. They buried their dead with honor and baptized their children with pride, even when the state refused to document their births. One of the company's worst abuses was environmental: the use of dangerous chemicals and the destruction of ecosystems. Entire rivers were poisoned. Disease spread rapidly among workers: malaria, hookworm, respiratory infections. Medical attention, when given, was often poor or delayed. Still, the Afro-Caribbean communities of Limon found ways to survive. And not just survive, to preserve. They preserved their language, speaking a unique Creole dialect shaped by Jamaican patois, English, and Spanish. They preserved their music, importing and evolving reggae, mento, calypso, and gospel in the heart of the jungle. They preserved their foodways, turning cassava, plantains, and coconut into dishes that told stories of both hardship and hope. They preserved their faith, blending Anglican, Baptist, Pentecostal, and Rastafarian traditions into a spiritual fabric that rejected the dehumanization of plantation life. And in the face of racial laws that forbade them from moving to the Costa Rican interior, enforced until 1949, they built self-sufficient towns, developed schools, and educated their own children. These were not merely laborers. They were cultural architects. By the 1930s, strikes began to erupt. Though often crushed, they signaled a turning tide. The Jamaican Costa Rican communities were no longer willing to accept second-class status. The children of the railroad and banana fields were now teachers, preachers, activists, and visionaries. And their cultural impact was undeniable. Limon had become a Caribbean enclave in Central America. Reggae echoed from open windows. Ackee and saltfish sizzled in iron pots. English-language newspapers circulated stories of both local triumphs and Jamaican news. The bloodlines may have crossed the sea, but the soul had never left the island. In the next chapter, we turn to that resistance in motion, how Black Costa Ricans, led by Jamaican descendants, pushed against legal segregation, built cultural movements, and laid the groundwork for a national reckoning. Behind the color line, segregation, struggle, and the roots of Afro-Costa Rican identity. By the early 20th century, the Jamaican presence in Costa Rica was no longer just visible. It was foundational. Afro-Caribbean communities had transformed the Atlantic coast into a cultural stronghold of resistance, language, music, and faith. But the reward for this contribution wasn't equality. It was exclusion. In 1904, the Costa Rican government made it law. Black people, especially Jamaicans, were forbidden from entering the Central Valley or becoming Costa Rican citizens. The legislation was not subtle. It was rooted in fear. Fear of blackness, fear of cultural change, and fear that the growing Jamaican population could threaten the country's self-image as a white Catholic nation. It was the beginning of legalized apartheid on Costa Rican soil. The law turned Puerto Limon and the surrounding regions into an open-air cage. Afro-Costa Ricans, born and raised on the land, were effectively stateless. They could not travel freely. They could not own land in many places. They could not vote. Their schools were underfunded, their roads unpaved, their communities neglected. They were Costa Rican in body, but not in status. Many Jamaicans who had immigrated decades earlier were now aging. They had buried loved ones, raised children, built churches. Yet they were still called aliens. And their children, the second generation born in Limon, they were still considered foreigners by the state. But as with every chapter of Caribbean history, oppression sparked self-reliance. In Limon, a network of Black institutions emerged. Anglican and Baptist churches became more than places of worship. They were schools, libraries, social halls, and safe spaces. Teachers, often trained abroad in Jamaica or Panama, returned to educate children in English, math, history, and African-Caribbean heritage. Women played a central role. Jamaican women organized literacy classes, distributed herbal medicine, and formed mutual aid societies. These women became the backbone of Limon's survival. Mothers, nurses, educators, activists. Language, too, was a battleground. While Spanish was Costa Rica's official language, Limon vibrated with Limonese Creole, a dialect shaped by Jamaican patois, English grammar, African linguistic patterns, and Central American influence. Speaking it in public could bring mockery or discrimination. But at home, in schools, and in the streets, it endured, a living symbol of cultural resistance. As the 1920s and 1930s unfolded, the rest of Costa Rica began to industrialize. But the Atlantic coast remained deliberately underdeveloped, by design. Roads that connected San Jose to the Pacific were expanded. Those to Limon remained gravel. Infrastructure was sparse. Government investment? Rare. Still, the music kept playing. Reggae, though decades away from global fame, had already taken root. So had mento, calypso, and spiritual gospel traditions. Jamaican Costa Ricans hosted music festivals and carnivals, blending African drumming with Christian hymns, Caribbean syncopation with Latin brass. Children in Limon grew up knowing the rhythms of Bob Marley and Lord Kitchener, as well as the Spanish national anthem. Identity wasn't binary, it was fused. A hybrid consciousness emerged. Not quite Costa Rican in the government's eyes, but deeply rooted in the land, the rhythm, and the fight for dignity. The tension exploded in the 1940s and 1950s. Educated Afro-Costa Ricans, many of them fluent in English, well-read, and internationally connected, began demanding rights. They wrote letters to lawmakers. They challenged discriminatory policies. They formed Black political blocs and cultural organizations. World War II added fuel to the fire. The rhetoric of democracy abroad and racial segregation at home no longer matched. How could Costa Rica claim moral authority on the world stage while banning its own citizens from full participation? Finally, in 1949, after decades of pressure, Costa Rica rewrote its constitution. The segregation laws were repealed. Black Costa Ricans were granted full citizenship. The travel ban to the Central Valley was lifted. But the scars remained. The struggle for rights had forged something deeper than legal recognition. It had crystallized a collective identity. Afro-Costa Ricans, especially those of Jamaican descent, knew they were not simply laborers or outsiders. They were carriers of a legacy, descendants of proud islanders who had crossed the sea, built the nation's infrastructure, and withstood a century of exclusion. Today, many still speak of Limón as a country within a country. Its soul is Caribbean. Its heartbeat is reggae. Its stories are bilingual. Its people still remember the days behind the color line. Not to dwell, but to affirm how far they've come. And in the next chapter, we'll explore that legacy in full bloom. How music, food, and language became acts of resistance. And how Limón became a living archive of Jamaican identity on foreign soil. Rhythms of resistance, reggae, food, and the spirit of Limón. To understand Limón is to understand that resistance doesn't always carry a gun. Sometimes it carries a drum, a recipe, a hymn, a song played on a handmade guitar under a zinc roof as the rain falls. After the laws changed in 1949, Afro-Costa Ricans, especially those descended from Jamaican migrants, didn't just step into the light politically, they bloomed culturally. In Limón, everything that had been used to survive segregation now evolved into a vibrant, undeniable identity. And at the center of this cultural rebirth were three powerful tools: reggae music, Jamaican food traditions, and language. Music as memory and movement. Walk down the dusty streets of Barrio Roosevelt or Cieneguita in the 1950s and 60s, and you'd hear it pulsing from the patios. Early ska, mento, and calypso, the heartbeat of the Caribbean. Then came reggae. Bob Marley's voice made it across the sea before many Costa Ricans had even heard his name. His lyrics about Babylon, justice, and redemption resonated deeply in Limón, where Black Costa Ricans were still excluded from full opportunity despite their new constitutional rights. His music, and the music of Gregory Isaacs, Peter Tosh, Burning Spear, and Jimmy Cliff, wasn't just entertainment. It was scripture, a soundtrack for the soul. Limón developed its own reggae scene, spawning local bands, sound systems, and DJ culture that mirrored Kingston's musical evolution. Youth wore dreadlocks, studied Rastafarian beliefs, and formed roots collectives blending African traditions with local Costa Rican realities. Gospel and spirituals merged with calypso and dancehall. Church choirs sang Marley lyrics during praise breaks. Reggae became more than rhythm. It was resistance, an affirmation of Black identity in a society that still looked west for validation. Food as ancestral code. Then there was the food. And like music, it told a deeper story. In every pot of rundown, every plate of rice and peas, every bite of patties, there were traces of Africa, Jamaica, and generations of women who cooked without written recipes, only memory. Coconut milk bubbled into stews. Scotch bonnet peppers sparked heat. Ackee, though rare, was sometimes smuggled in by returning relatives and shared like treasure. Jamaican dishes, often made with limited resources, were acts of preservation. When Costa Rica's interior ignored Limón, these meals became cultural anchors, linking people to a homeland they'd never seen but deeply felt. The recipes were not taught in schools. They were passed down in kitchens and whispered between generations. And they were sacred. Food festivals eventually emerged, often during Carnival and Black Heritage months, where younger Costa Ricans sampled the jerk chicken, boiled banana, fried plantain, and coconut bread that had fueled the railroad workers and banana laborers decades before. To eat Jamaican food in Limón wasn't just to taste the past, it was to inherit it. Language as defiance. And then came the voice, the way Jamaicans in Costa Rica spoke. Limonese Creole, or Patois as it was casually called, was shaped in defiance of silence. It evolved through isolation, oral transmission, and necessity. A mixture of English, Jamaican patois, African grammatical structures, and borrowed Spanish terms. It was fast, rhythmic, musical. The state discouraged it. Spanish-only policies were enforced in schools and media. Students were punished for speaking Creole in class. Employers often demanded Spanish fluency, even in Limón. And yet the language endured. Elders taught it at home. Songs were sung in it. Sermons delivered in it. Children grew up bilingual, switching tongues depending on who was listening. Creole became a language of intimacy, identity, and inclusion. Speaking it was not just cultural, it was political. The spirit of Limón today. By the 1980s and 1990s, Limón had carved out a distinct place in the Costa Rican landscape. It was not a copy of Jamaica, nor fully accepted by mainstream Costa Rican society. It was its own nation within a nation. a space of survival, pride, and cultural power. Reggae music was now played on national radio. Local artists were recording and touring. Jamaican food was served in restaurants as Costa Rica's multicultural appetite slowly expanded. Creole phrases began appearing in local TV and theater. Afro-Costa Rican fashion, hair, and aesthetics, once ridiculed, became expressions of beauty and strength. But the struggle wasn't over. Systemic racism lingered. Economic neglect continued. Limón still faced higher poverty, fewer resources, and unequal investment compared to the rest of Costa Rica. Yet the people, unshaken, the spirit of Limón remained, anchored by a Jamaican identity that had never been erased, only rerooted in foreign soil. In the next chapter, we dive deeper into that modern struggle, the fight for visibility, equity, and cultural recognition in 21st century Costa Rica, as Jamaican descendants continue to build bridges across the Caribbean and fight for a seat at the national table. New roots, old fights, Afro-Costa Rican voices in the modern nation. The laws had changed. Citizenship was no longer denied. The trains still ran, the bananas still grew, and Costa Rica began to brand itself to the world as a beacon of peace and democracy. But for the Afro-Costa Rican community, especially those descended from Jamaican migrants, inclusion was still a struggle wrapped in a smile. A new generation was coming of age in Limón, one that had never known the railroad, never worked the banana fields, and never seen the steamships that carried their ancestors to a new life. But they knew the legacy. They carried it in their names, their songs, their faith, and their skin. And they were ready to confront the old fights under new terms. The promise of national belonging. By the late 20th century, Costa Rica had transformed into a global tourism darling, eco-paradise, stable democracy, progressive politics. But beneath the surface, deep inequalities persisted. While tourists marveled at rainforests and sloths in the Central Valley or Pacific beaches, Limón remained underdeveloped. Unemployment in Afro-Costa Rican communities was disproportionately high. Access to quality healthcare and education lagged behind. Infrastructure, roads, hospitals, communication systems remained outdated or neglected. Black Costa Ricans were often absent from media representation, political leadership, and elite institutions. Afro-Costa Rican youth were tired of being asked, "Where are you from?" as if their birthright was still foreign. They were born in Limón, raised in Costa Rica. But national recognition was still uneven, both in policy and perception. Cultural revival as protest. Faced with erasure, many young Afro-Costa Ricans turned to the same tools their ancestors had used. Culture as defiance. Reggae saw a powerful revival in the 1990s and 2000s with the rise of local artists who sang in both Spanish and Limonese Creole, mixing dancehall with social commentary. Artists like Santos Wizerdo, Kingo Lovers, and Fertile Mish used music to question state neglect and uplift Black pride. Fashion became political. Dreadlocks, head wraps, and African prints weren't trends, they were declarations. Language was reclaimed. Schools in Limón began offering Creole alongside Spanish. Bilingual media slowly emerged. Elders were invited to teach oral history to the youth. Food festivals, carnival celebrations, and Afro-Caribbean literature were platforms of resistance. Not just for cultural pride, but for visibility. And on the streets, protests emerged. Activism and visibility. By the 2010s, Afro-Costa Rican activists were pushing hard for systemic change. They demanded inclusion in national curriculums. "Why don't we learn about the Jamaican railroad workers in history class?" They demanded infrastructure. "Why is Limón still waiting for the roads San Jose got 30 years ago?" They demanded representation. "Where are the Black politicians in power?" Groups like Centro Cultural de Limón, Foundation Afrodescendientes, and young political leaders like Epsi Campbell Barr, who would become Costa Rica's first Afro-descendant vice president in 2018, emerged as key voices. Her rise was not just symbolic. It was generational vindication. For the first time, many Afro-Costa Ricans saw someone who looked like them in the halls of power. Someone with roots in Limón, who spoke of Jamaican ancestors and the need to dismantle institutional racism. But progress was, and remains, uneven. The rise of Afrofuturism and digital identity. In recent years, a digital generation of Afro-Costa Rican creators, thinkers, and storytellers has emerged. On YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram, young Limonenses reclaim their identity on their own terms. They remix reggae with trap and Afrobeat. They speak Creole in skits and spoken word. They challenge colorism, classism, and the invisibility of Black beauty in Costa Rican media. They film their grandparents telling stories in Patois. They document their food, their style, their truth. They do not wait for recognition. They demand it. Afrofuturism has found a small but growing home in Limón. Speculative fiction, art, and performance that envisions Black Caribbean futures untouched by colonialism. Young writers imagine a Limón where the United Fruit never came, where Jamaicans built a free republic on the coast, where Creole is the language of law and reggae is studied in school. A new consciousness. This is the moment the descendants of Jamaican laborers now occupy. A space between gratitude and grievance, pride and protest. They love Costa Rica, but they also challenge it to be better, to recognize its Black Caribbean soul. Because Limón is not a footnote in Costa Rican history. It is the pulse. Without Jamaican laborers, there is no railroad. Without Afro-Caribbean strength, there is no banana boom. Without reggae, there is no Costa Rican rhythm. The struggle continues, in courts, classrooms, studios, kitchens, and streets. But so does the spirit. In the next chapter, we'll travel deeper into diaspora consciousness, exploring how Jamaican descendants in Costa Rica connect with other Caribbean communities in Panama, Nicaragua, Honduras, and even back home in Jamaica, maintaining a Pan-African identity that stretches across waters and generations. Across waters, across time, Jamaica, diaspora, and the Pan-Caribbean identity. A man in Limón plays a hand-carved drum with the same rhythm his grandfather used on the docks. A woman in Colón, Panama, stirs coconut milk into rice and peas, telling her daughter stories in Jamaican patois. A young man in Nicaragua listens to Burning Spear on his cracked phone screen while writing spoken word poetry about his grandmother's boat ride from Kingston. These are not coincidences. They are echoes of one shared migration, one cultural seed scattered across multiple lands, watered by struggle and fed by pride. This is the Pan-Caribbean identity, a force deeper than borders, more enduring than flags. And it is rooted in the journeys of Jamaican people who, through the trauma of labor exportation and the power of cultural survival, stitched together a legacy across nations. The Caribbean beyond the Caribbean. For most people, Caribbean means islands. But in truth, the Caribbean is not just geography, it's experience. It lives in port towns, market stalls, train tracks, and Creole dialects that stretch all the way from Belize to Brazil. The Jamaican diaspora, especially during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, helped define that reality. In Costa Rica, they built the railroad and banana economy. In Panama, they built the canal. In Cuba, they harvested sugar. In Nicaragua and Honduras, they picked bananas under the same United Fruit Empire. In Colombia, they settled coastal towns like San Andres and Cartagena. Each place developed its own rhythms and struggles. But the Jamaican thread was unmistakable. In the accents, the food, the churches, and the sound systems. The Creole connection. One of the strongest cultural ties in the Jamaican diaspora is language. Not just English, but Creole. In Costa Rica's Limón, it's Limonese Creole. In Panama's Colón, it's a variation of Jamaican patois. In Nicaragua's Bluefields, the same melodic speech fills the streets. These dialects are cousins, born of English, baptized in African grammar, and evolved through generations of resistance and cultural adaptation. To speak Creole in these places is to belong to a diasporic nation that spans thousands of miles, yet shares common roots. When a Costa Rican of Jamaican descent meets a Nicaraguan of Jamaican descent, they might not have passports in common, but they recognize each other immediately. The rhythm of the speech, the seasoning of the food, the sway of the music. It is familial, spiritual and musical syncretism. Across the diaspora, Rastafarianism, Pentecostalism, and African-rooted Christianity form a complex spiritual ecosystem. In Limón, Panama, and Nicaragua, reggae gospel is just as common as traditional hymns. Sunday services mix fiery preaching with bass lines and tambourines. Music travels faster than borders. Before the internet, cassette tapes passed through ships and family reunions. Bob Marley was worshipped like a prophet. Culture poured back and forth across the Caribbean Sea. Reverse migration became as powerful as the original journey. Today, artists from Jamaica perform in Limón and Bluefields. collaborations happened between Panamanian reggaeton stars and Costa Rican dancehall singers. These are not just entertainment. They are affirmations of belonging. Return to Zion. But where is home? Many Afro-Costa Ricans, especially younger generations, dream of visiting Jamaica. Some have. Others never will. But the emotional connection is profound. Jamaica is the spiritual homeland, the symbolic center of their identity. Even if their ancestors left over 100 years ago. But for some, Costa Rica is Jamaica. It's where their grandfather told stories about Kingston, even if he was born in Puerto Limon. It's where the music, the food, and the rituals live. This duality, of belonging everywhere and nowhere, is a hallmark of the Pan-Caribbean identity. The Jamaican diaspora has created floating islands of identity, anchored by memory, language, and culture, even when the land beneath them has changed. Pan-Africanism and political consciousness. The diasporic consciousness isn't just cultural, it's political. In Costa Rica, Afro-Caribbean leaders draw strength from Marcus Garvey's legacy. His vision of Black self-reliance and global unity resonates deeply with communities that still fight for full inclusion. Afro-Costa Rican organizers coordinate with activists in Belize, Panama, and Colombia. Conferences, cultural exchanges, and social media platforms now serve as digital Pan-Caribbean spaces where shared challenges, from racism to economic exclusion, are confronted collectively. The fight is no longer isolated. It is interconnected. One people, many lands. To be Jamaican in Costa Rica is to carry more than a passport or a last name. It is to carry a torch, passed from cane fields to railroad tracks to classrooms to carnival stages. It is to speak a language born of resistance, to move to a rhythm that defied slavery and silence, to eat from a plate that carries stories, to know that your roots stretch from Kingston to Limon to Cologne to Bluefields, and back again. This chapter of Caribbean history reminds us that borders are political, but identity is ancestral. From Limon to the world, youth culture, globalization, and the future of Afro-Costa Rica, Limon stands at a crossroads. The rusted railroad tracks laid by Jamaican hands still crisscross the land, silent now but sacred. The banana plantations still stretch inland, symbols of labor and legacy. But it is no longer the drums of the past that drive the rhythm of Limon. It is the beat of a new generation, louder, prouder, and digitally connected to the world. Afro-Costa Rican youth, the great-great-grandchildren of Jamaican migrants, are reimagining what it means to be Black, Caribbean, and Costa Rican in the 21st century. And they're doing it with smartphones, microphones, turntables, cameras, and conviction. This is a generation not just shaped by history, but reshaping it. A new sound emerges. Walk through the streets of Limon today, and you'll hear a fusion of worlds. Reggae still lives, but so does Afrobeat, trap, reggaeton, dancehall, and even spoken word poetry layered over lo-fi beats. This generation doesn't abandon the roots, they remix them. Young artists in Limon are blending old-school patois with digital production, creating a unique genre that's both globally inspired and deeply local. These tracks hit YouTube before they hit radio. They're shared in WhatsApp groups, blasted from motorbikes, played at high school block parties, and downloaded from SoundCloud at the port docks. And the message? Still resistance. Still identity. Still Caribbean. But now it's about police harassment. About colorism in the job market. About feeling invisible on the national stage, even while being hyper-visible on social media. Their music is therapy, protest, documentation, Creole, code switching, and cultural confidence. Language, once suppressed, is now a badge of honor. Patois, or Limonese Creole, is no longer just what your abuela speaks at home. It's being rapped, tweeted, subtitled, and included in screenplays. Teenagers switch between three languages in a single conversation. Spanish for school, English for global platforms, and Creole for family, humor, and heart. It's not confusion, it's cultural fluency. Afro-Costa Rican youth today are asserting their triple identity. Black like their ancestors, Caribbean like their rhythm, Costa Rican by birthright and pride. They know their story doesn't begin in San Jose, and that's okay. They've stopped asking for permission to belong. Now they declare it. Afrocentric fashion and aesthetic reclamation. From dreadlocks to Ankara prints, gold hoops to beaded bracelets, Afro-Costa Rican fashion is a rebellion against invisibility. Girls wear braids in styles inspired by Nigeria, Trinidad, and Atlanta. boys rock dashikis with Nike Airs. It's not about trends. It's about tracing lineage. This aesthetic is an act of memory. It says, we know where we came from, and we look damn good doing it. For decades, the Costa Rican media industry pushed Eurocentric beauty standards. But the youth in Limon are pushing back. They use Instagram to showcase natural hair tutorials, melanin glow routines, and Afro-style photo shoots that rival any urban magazine spread. They're not waiting to be seen. They're making themselves visible. Digital resistance and global solidarity. Globalization, once feared as a threat to culture, is now a tool of cultural warfare. Young activists and creatives in Limon are using the internet to archive oral histories, upload dancehall documentaries, crowdsource scholarships, fund community gardens, sell Afro-Caribbean art, connect with other Black Latinx and Afro-Caribbean movements across the diaspora. They form WhatsApp groups with youth from Panama, Jamaica, Belize, and Cuba. They share TikToks that mix protest slogans with carnival energy. They read Malcolm X and Audre Lorde, quote Buju Banton and Nipsey Hussle, and launch GoFundMes to save community centers. Limon's youth don't just consume the global Black experience. They contribute to it. Education and economic aspiration. But for all the cultural pride, economic inequality remains a barrier. Unemployment is still high in Limon. Opportunities remain centralized in San Jose. Resources are scarce. Public schools are underfunded. Young Afro-Costa Ricans often feel like second-class citizens in their own country. So they hustle. Some go into music, tourism, or tech. Others migrate abroad and send money back. Some study law, social work, or journalism to fight the system from within. Education is seen not just as a path to personal success, but a way to uplift entire communities. The future they're building. Today's Afro-Costa Rican youth are multilingual, multimedia, and multilayered. They are cultural diplomats, musical revolutionaries, and digital archivists. They aren't waiting for textbooks to include their stories. They're telling them on their own platforms. They want a Limon that thrives, not just survives. A Costa Rica that celebrates Blackness, not just tolerates it. A Caribbean future that is connected, creative, and unapologetically free. In the next chapter, we'll trace the influence of Afro-Costa Rican voices on national culture, from politics to poetry, education to entrepreneurship, and how the Jamaican legacy is finally being recognized not as a side note, but as a central pillar of Costa Rica's modern identity. Black and national, how Jamaica shaped the soul of Costa Rica. For more than a century, Afro-Costa Ricans, especially those of Jamaican descent, were seen as outsiders in their own land. Their labor was used. Their music was borrowed. Their culture was dismissed. And their rights were delayed. But the truth, rooted in railroads and reggae, language and labor, is now undeniable. Jamaicans helped build Costa Rica. Not just physically, but spiritually, musically, and culturally. This chapter isn't about asking for recognition. It's about taking a seat at the center of the story. Because to understand modern Costa Rica, its soul, its sound, its Caribbean flavor, you must understand the Jamaican legacy that lives within it. Foundations beneath the surface. Start with the basics, infrastructure. There is no Costa Rican railroad without Jamaicans. The steel rails, the ports, the trestles that allowed coffee and bananas to reach the world, all laid by Jamaican hands in malaria-infested jungles under foreign contractors. Then there's agriculture. The banana industry, which became Costa Rica's golden goose for decades, was powered by Afro-Caribbean labor. United Fruit profited from black sweat, and that profit fed the national economy, funded modernization, and helped shape Costa Rica's international identity. And yet, for generations, these truths were buried. History textbooks skipped the names. National holidays ignored the contribution. The Jamaican presence was footnoted, if not erased. But today, the veil is lifting. Reggae in the mainstream. There was a time when reggae music was confined to Limon, a subculture within a segregated region. Now, it's played at national festivals. It's taught in music classes. Costa Rican reggae bands headline international stages, and the influence of Jamaican rhythm runs through the veins of national soundscapes. Turn on the radio in San Jose, and you might hear a fusion of reggaeton and roots reggae, Costa Rican artists singing in Spanish over rhythms that would feel at home in Trenchtown. Even national ads for banks, telecom companies, and tourism campaigns use Caribbean-inflected soundtracks to sell Pura Vida. It's not appropriation anymore, it's integration. Jamaican food in the national diet. Coconut rice, jerk chicken, plantain tart, curry goat, once dismissed as ethnic or foreign, now appear on menus in cities across Costa Rica. Afro-Caribbean cuisine has become a national treasure. Food tourism in Limon is booming, and culinary schools now offer modules on Afro-Costa Rican cooking techniques. Every spoonful of rondon, the beloved coconut seafood stew, tells a story of migration, memory, and survival. When Costa Ricans taste it, they're not just eating, they're absorbing history, language, law, and learning. Limonese Creole is still not an official language, but it's no longer shameful. In fact, it's being preserved and taught in schools, cultural centers, and linguistic workshops. The government has funded efforts to document Creole and recognize it as part of the nation's intangible heritage. Scholars now study its structure. Playwrights use it. Poets celebrate it. Meanwhile, universities across the country are offering more courses on Afro-Caribbean studies, teaching the stories that were once missing. From Marcus Garvey's impact to the Limon strikes, from reggae's spiritual philosophy to Jamaican migration routes. Even law schools are examining the racial inequalities baked into Costa Rican policy, sparked by the activism of Black Costa Ricans reclaiming their role in national history. Representation at last. Epsie Campbell Barr's appointment as Vice President of Costa Rica in 2018 shattered a barrier. As a Black woman of Jamaican descent, her presence in the second highest office of the land was not just symbolic. It was a statement. Her speeches spoke of identity, justice, and inclusion. She cited the railroad workers. She called out historical racism. She made it national policy to include Afro-descendants in development planning, cultural programs, and educational reform. More Afro-Costa Ricans are now in government, law, education, and entrepreneurship than ever before. Young girls in Limon now grow up knowing they too can lead. The nation redefined. Costa Rica's national identity is no longer singular. It's plural. No longer monocultural, but Caribbean, indigenous, African, mestizo, and global. The Jamaican legacy lives in the rhythm of the national soundscape, the richness of the national kitchen, the strength of the national conscience, the boldness of national protest, the beauty of Blackness in the national mirror. To be Black in Costa Rica is no longer to live on the margins. It is to stand within the center, unshakable, undeniable, and unforgotten. In the next chapter, we celebrate the cultural bridge that Jamaican Costa Ricans continue to build. Through carnival, storytelling, visual art, film, and Pan-African consciousness, forging a legacy that connects Jamaica not only to Costa Rica, but to the world. Carnival, culture, and the Caribbean soul of Costa Rica. There are no fences at carnival, no borders, no bureaucracy, only rhythm, color, movement, and memory. In the streets of Limon every October, a transformation takes place. One that tears down the old silence and replaces it with drums, feathers, brass, whistles, and bare feet pounding the pavement to ancient rhythms. It is carnival, but it is also resistance wrapped in celebration. A living monument to Jamaican ancestors who crossed the sea, bent under sugar and banana empires, survived state-imposed invisibility, and left behind a culture too vibrant to be erased. In this chapter, we step into the noise, the soul, the street, and discover how carnival and Caribbean art forms have cemented Afro-Costa Ricans as the keepers of a cultural fire that still burns bright across borders. A celebration born of struggle. Carnival in Limon isn't a carbon copy of Trinidad or Brazil. It's its own creation, born from a fusion of Jamaican tradition, African ancestry, and Costa Rican landscape. The festival began as a grassroots effort, a celebration for and by the Black community. At first, it was informal. People gathered to dance, play music, cook, and honor their roots. No permits, no state sponsorship, just culture, alive and unfiltered. Eventually, it evolved into a national event, drawing tens of thousands of visitors from across the country and beyond. But carnival in Limon was never just about fun. It was, and remains, an act of cultural assertion, a way to say, we are here. We belong. We matter. Masquerade, memory, and meaning. At first glance, the costumes are dazzling. Bright feathers, gold masks, sequined bodysuits, and painted skin. But underneath, symbolism. Many costumes reference African royalty, golden crowns, warrior shields, leopard prints, tribal markings. Others reference the working-class history of Limón. Banana pickers, railroad workers, market vendors, and church mothers turned into icons of strength. There are also satirical floats, where dancers mock colonial symbols, political hypocrisy, or police injustice. These are not just performances, they are public critiques delivered in rhythm. The choreography often tells a story, a slave ship arrival, a revolt, a march for justice, a spiritual awakening. The streets become the stage, the people the actors, the city the canvas, the music that moves the nation. Carnival is powered by sound systems, modern descendants of Jamaican street parties. Trucks stacked with speakers drive slowly through the crowd, blasting reggae, calypso, dancehall, soca, and increasingly Afrobeat and Caribbean Latin fusions. Local DJs compete with each other for the loudest bass, the deepest drops, the most spiritual rhythms. It's not just a competition, it's a resurrection. You hear echoes of Peter Tosh, Sister Nancy, and Buju Banton riding over the beat of new Costa Rican artists. But the soul of carnival remains the live drums, gem bata congas, hand-struck by musicians channeling ancestral power. The rhythm is African. The spirit is Jamaican. The performance is Costa Rican. Children dance barefoot in the dust. Elders sway slowly, watching the baton being passed, from one generation to the next, rhythm to rhythm. Food is celebration and continuity. Every block of carnival smells like home. Grills sizzle with jerk chicken and pepper shrimp. Vendors sell patty, plantain, and coconut water in plastic bags. Booths fry festival, steam callaloo, and serve bowls of rundin so rich it makes you forget the crowd. The food isn't just sustenance, it's storytelling. Each bite holds centuries of memory. What was cooked during famine, what was shared during struggle, what was passed down from grandmother to mother to son. To eat at carnival is to taste history made edible. Visual art and cultural archiving. Beyond the parades, carnival also sparks an explosion in visual expression. Murals of Marcus Garvey, Bob Marley, and Limón heroes appear across town. Painters set up booths to sell portraits of Black women in head wraps, dancers frozen midspin, old Jamaican churches in watercolor. Poets perform in Creole, telling stories of fathers who never got land titles, mothers who raised nations from one-room houses, and lovers who left for Panama and never came back. Limón's artists use carnival to archive what textbooks omitted, turning canvas, poetry, and performance into historical record, from local to global. Thanks to social media and Caribbean cultural networks, Limón's carnival is no longer just a regional event. It's pan-Caribbean and global. Diaspora Jamaicans visit for reconnection. Scholars come to document oral history. Young Afro-descendants from Nicaragua, Panama, and the U.S. fly in to witness a carnival that feels like theirs too. It's no longer just Costa Rica's celebration. It's Jamaica's voice speaking through Costa Rican lungs. Limón becomes a temporary capital of Black identity, Pan-African pride, and post-colonial power. A place where drums are louder than silence and color breaks through every imposed border. In the next chapter, we explore how this living, breathing cultural movement is preserved through education, oral history, digital archiving, and future planning to ensure that the legacy of the Jamaican Costa Rican experience lives long after the drums go silent. The Living Archive, preserving Jamaican legacy in Costa Rica's future. A culture dies not when people forget it, but when they stop protecting it. And in Limón, Costa Rica, where the echoes of Jamaican voices still ring through the alleys, churches, kitchens, and carnival streets, the fight to preserve that legacy is more urgent than ever. Because culture, like memory, is fragile. And in a world of rapid globalization, gentrification, and digital noise, even the loudest rhythms can be drowned out. But the Afro-Costa Rican community, descendants of those first Jamaican migrants who came seeking work and found exile, is refusing to let history fade. They are building a living archive, not a museum of artifacts, but a daily, breathing, fighting preservation of identity. This is the story of how a people protect the soul of their journey, through schools, songs, scripts, and strategy. Education as resistance. In Limón today, teachers are warriors. For decades, Costa Rican classrooms taught a whitewashed national narrative, one that erased the Black railroad workers, ignored the banana plantation abuses, and skipped the language of Limón altogether. Now that is changing. Afro-Costa Rican educators, historians, and parents are rewriting lesson plans. they are integrating Afro-Caribbean studies into public schools. Lessons on Jamaican Migration, the 1949 Civil Rights Breakthrough, Limonese Creole, Reggae History, and the Contribution of Black Costa Ricans to National Development. At the university level, programs like those at the Universidad de Costa Rica's Caribbean Studies Institute are producing groundbreaking research. Oral history projects, digitized archives, and public exhibitions are preserving stories once at risk of disappearing forever. These aren't just academic exercises. They are acts of cultural survival, digital storytelling, and community archiving. In the hands of young creators, Instagram has become a classroom, YouTube a time capsule, and TikTok a protest banner. Teenagers in Limon record elders speaking Creole and upload them as language lessons. Others film short documentaries about carnival or interview grandmothers about how they cook jerk chicken during hard times. Websites now host digitized immigration records of Jamaicans who arrived in the late 1800s. Podcasts explore Black Costa Rican literature. Social media campaigns celebrate Afro-Costa Rican History Month and spotlight Black-owned businesses, poets, artists, and elders. In a country where Blackness was once silenced, now the digital space speaks loudly. Community centers and cultural hubs. Physical spaces matter too. Across Limon, grassroots initiatives are turning abandoned buildings into cultural sanctuaries. Places like the Centro Cultural de Limon host dance classes, theater workshops, language immersion programs, and visual arts festivals. They preserve music and movement, not by locking them away, but by teaching them to the next generation. One program teaches youth how to build and play traditional drums from scratch. Another leads oral storytelling circles, where kids learn how to carry the ancestors by learning old songs, fables, and biblical passages in Creole. These spaces are where the archive lives, laughs, and dances. Policy, politics, and protection. Culture cannot survive without protection. Afro-Costa Rican leaders are pushing for stronger policies to defend their legacy. This includes official recognition of Limonese Creole as part of Costa Rica's cultural heritage, legal safeguards against displacement and gentrification in Limon, funding for Black cultural institutions, inclusion of Afro-Caribbean voices in National Heritage Councils, permanent days of remembrance, including Jamaican Emigration Day. Costa Rica is listening more than ever before, but progress remains uneven. That's why Afro-descendant politicians, lawyers, and civil rights groups continue the work, fighting not just for land or laws, but for memory. Because the moment you remove a community from its story, you remove its power. Children of the archive. In the end, the true guardians of the Jamaican legacy in Costa Rica are not just scholars or politicians, but children. A girl singing Marley's redemption song at a school recital. A boy reciting a poem in Creole at a town hall. A teenager asking his grandmother to teach him how to make coconut bread from scratch. A youth group recreating the 1949 abolition of segregation as street theater. A muralist painting the words, "Why still day ya?" We're still here, across the wall of a Limon train station. These children are not relics of the past. They are the future custodians of the archive. They carry in their voices the railway, the rebellion, the rhythm, and the rebirth. The story lives on. The Jamaican legacy in Costa Rica is not over, it is evolving. It is rooted in hardship, but branches into hope. It was born from migration, but matures through resistance. It echoes in churches, sound systems, kitchens, and classrooms. It whispers through Creole, marches through carnival, and rises in the national anthem when sung with full awareness of who built the land beneath their feet. This is not just the story of Costa Rica. This is the story of every Caribbean person who left home and made a new one, who turned survival into identity and memory into power.